Well, an apt poem. I won't obviously read it all because it'll take forever, but once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more." This will make sense in a minute. A couple years ago, I was at a clergy conference in Estes Park with a couple of my priest buddies, and I remember it was my birthday. We went on a hike. I don't think it was Long Peaks, but it might have been. I don't recall. I just remember I was seriously winded, running out of gas. But I remember from that day a tremendous view and a scene I shall ne'er forget. Now, in and around Estes and in Rocky Mountain National Forest, you know that the squirrels are gray. You ever seen a gray squirrel? I hate squirrels. But gray ones, at least, are kind of interesting to look at. So I was watching one of these squirrels, and boom, it disappeared right in front of my eyes. A huge black bird came and scooped it up and took it away for a treat. When I think of Elijah and I think of this story about the widow, I actually think of a raven, which is what the poem was, by the way, because previous in our Old Testament passage, Elijah warned King Ahab. You remember Ahab was the idolater with his wife Jezebel. He said there will be a drought and hence a famine in the land. Then the Lord drove Elijah to the east by the brook Cherith near the Jordan River. And there Elijah was sustained by that brook by a raven. He drank from the brook, and the raven brought him meat. I don't know if we want to know what kind of meat that was, but the raven brought it to him. But then the Lord does something interesting. He sends Elijah to Gentile lands up north, to Sidon. Now, I never had realized the parallels between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman. You know that story? Don't throw the bread to the dogs, that kind of thing. But now Elijah sent there. This is previous, of course, to the Gentiles. Now the Torah and the prophets state that God has a special place in his heart for orphans and widows. We just read that from the Psalm. Deuteronomy 10:18. God admonishes justice for the fatherless and the widow and loves the stranger. There are similar verses in Exodus, other parts of Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and the other prophets. So Elijah is actually sent specifically to a Gentile widow. Highly unusual. Just north of the Sea of Galilee. Because they were also affected by drought. Well, Elijah does something interesting. He asks the woman for water during a drought. And for the bread that's in her hands. She fetches the water. In the process, Elijah learns she's about to make her last meal for she and her little son. All she has is a little flour and oil. Elijah goes further. "Make me a little cake." Well, she agrees. But Elijah says, because of these small provisions, the oil and flour would never run out. It would sustain them through all the drought. And so it was. But there's an interesting note in the story. What happens to the little boy? He gets sick and he dies. The widow is confused. Why did God send you, Elijah, just to kill us, in essence? Just to tease us. But Elijah goes into the son's room, and he does something fascinating. He opens his arms, He gets over the boy. He prays for him. He prays that God would bring the boy's spirit back, and it happens. Now, if we had time, we could go through the parallels that are fascinating here between the raven and Elijah. You've ever seen those old icons of John the Baptist? Sometimes he has wings. It's because he's a messenger of God. Elijah is actually acting in a similar way, sent by God to the widow, like the raven. God said Elijah would be provided for by the widow, but it's actually the other way around. Elijah's the messenger of provision to the widow herself. He is now the raven in the story, bringing provision sent by God to this lonely and helpless widow. God admonishes justice for the widow and the fatherless. But then we have another widow in today's gospel. Now keep that Old Testament background as you look at this widow, because Jesus is admonishing the scribes. He attacks the scribes' tendencies to show off religiously, with their robes and long public prayers, for their weakness in lusting after power. They craved power, admiration, and attention. Now, it's easy to pick on them. But do we not, in our world, does not everybody crave power, admiration, and attention? Os Guinness says we are in the age not only of the self, but of the selfie. St. Francis of Assisi gave everything a title by using the term brother or sister. Brother sun, sister moon, sister death. But he had a name for our human tendencies to these kinds of weaknesses, this pride, what Paul would call the flesh. That Francis named Brother Ass. Brother Ass. As in jackass. Now there is even a Franciscan trademark. If you've ever seen some of the pictures, a picture of a brother trying to drag a stubborn donkey with a very long leash. This is Brother Ass. Now if there's anything we have not mastered but welcomed into our lives is Brother Ass, especially in our craving for attention, admiration, and power. Yet the scribes had a deeper issue than just Brother Ass. They were exploiting widows. Jesus calls it devouring widows' houses. Now, this could mean sponging off their hospitality, but it could also mean robbing their estates. Remember, widows in the ancient world did not have any kind of rights of their own. They depended on their families. And when their families weren't around, they gave their property over to the religious leaders to take care of them. It's possible that some of them stole and skimmed the widow's property in the name of God. David Garland says they love recognition more than they love God, and they trample on those who are already crushed. Well, this makes our widow's mite, as it used to be called, all the more poignant. Jesus is watching the rich and powerful, and he's also watching this nameless widow putting in their tithes and offering. Now the Mishnah describes this process. In front of the temple was the court of women, and there were 13 shofar chests. These were like little boxes shaped like trumpets. And each of those chests had a particular area of the temple that it would go. So they represented a gift. So there were the shekel dues, there were the turtle dove offerings, pigeon offerings, wood for the altar, frankincense, gold for the mercy seat, and so on until you reach the last chest, which was called the free will offering. This was the chest that was used for miscellaneous stuff, the chest that had the smallest price tag. In other words, it was for the poor. Whatever you can muster. Well, this is where our widow dropped her copper coins, worth about a penny. Like the widow of Zarephath, this widow was down to the end of her resources. And she gave it all to the temple. Right back to those religious leaders. Think about that. One verse later, after our story, the disciples will look at the temple and say, "This is amazing." And Jesus will say, "It's coming down. This whole thing is coming down." So ironically, she's giving all that she has to a lost cause. Well, of course, this is a discipleship story, like that of our friend Bartimaeus, the blind man. The humble widow is a contrast to the religious leaders. And of course, Jesus saw the gift of the widow not going to a lost cause, but to God. But this is a scathing rebuke to the religious system of Jesus' day. The scribes, the protectors, the interpreters of the faith are the ones who are defying it by their refusal to care for the weakest among them. I got shoes, you got shoes. All God's children got shoes, said the slaves in the Negro spiritual who really didn't have shoes. When we get to heaven, we're going to put on our shoes and shout all over God's heaven. But everybody talking about heaven ain't going there. But the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees could not see was that the true treasures of the temple were not the gold and the ornamentation, but the anawin. This is a Hebrew word that means the little ones, the meek, the humble, the widow, and the orphan, who came to drop in their meager offering to God. It was the anawin, says Jesus, who will inherit the kingdom of heaven. It was the anawin, says Jesus, who will inherit the whole earth. Remember St. Simeon, who said, "One human being is of more value than the whole cosmos." The orphans and the widows were the true treasures of the temple. The Eastern Orthodox have a fascinating rite for the adoption of a child. We have one too, by the way. But when a baby there is brought to the church for adoption and presented, if it's a baby, the infant is actually placed on the ground. And the parents will put their foot over the infant's neck. Not put any pressure on it, of course, but almost as a symbol. But then both of the parents say in a powerful line, "Today you are our child. Today we have begotten you." And then they pick the child up and present him to God, him or her to God. Now this is a little strange, but I was been thinking about the origins of these kinds of things. Remember what the early Christians in the Roman Empire used to do, I remind you this all the time, with the little babies that were abandoned in the road, in the mountains, in the streets, on the side of the road. What would they do? Male, female, handicapped or not, they would pick the baby up and they would raise them themselves. Incidentally, sociologically, this is how Christianity, one of the reasons why it spread so long, so far, among so many people simply because Christians had more people in their family. The pagans were killing their children. The Christians were growing their families. It's just a very simple thing. But to those unwanted babies, they would say, "Today you are ours. This day we have begotten you." They were saving them from death. So I think that Orthodox rite actually looks back on this time. Perhaps you've heard the story of St. Lawrence. In 258, the Emperor Valerian beheaded the leadership of Rome. That would include the Pope, 6 deacons. Lawrence was also a deacon, and he was spared. But he was only spared because the city prefect wanted him to bring all the gold and all the chalices and all the things from the churches. "Bring me your treasures," he said, "and we will spare your life." So he did, in a different way. Lawrence brought what he called the wondrous riches of our God. You know what he presented to the prefect? He went through the lanes and the neighborhoods of Rome, and he brought with him the orphans, the widows, the sick, and the disabled. And he said, "Here are the treasures of God." And of course, he was martyred for that act. Now, really, the story of the widow, and we preachers often do the guilt thing. This is about giving, and in a sense it is, but mostly it's not. It's really about the people who God cares about the most, the Anawim, those who will inherit the kingdom, the poor and the humble, the widow and the orphan. These are the wondrous riches of our God. Amen.